Going to kick this one off, folks, with a bit of a cold open, an attempt to briefly explain a very interesting, a very terrifying period of history, beginning in 1966. This is in the People's Republic of China, actually just 2 short months after Pol Pot had left the country, following his little sojourn in Hanoi and then Beijing that we discussed a couple of episodes back. Now, it might be a little jarring, a little incongruous to begin with a question like this, but here I go. What is the most significant swim someone has ever done? Yes, the topic is swimming. What is the, I suppose, in terms of human life, human flourishing, human suffering, history generally? Not just accomplishing some particularly long or fast swim. What is, you know, the most... What is the most important swim someone has ever done? And you can imagine I'm going somewhere with this. I think I have an answer to a question that I can't imagine has been asked all that much, but here it is. Well, I would posit that the most significant swim someone has ever done was on the 16th of July, 1966. And it was performed by Mao Zedong in the Yangtze River near Wuhan. Imagine him. He's a pretty tall guy. He's in his early 70s at this point, fairly well upholstered, disrobing and getting into this wide, pale green brown river on a blustery day. The swim would last for over an hour, as the chairman used the strong current kind of to his advantage. He basically floated around 9 miles downstream and emerged on the other side. And that was it. That's it, folks. That might be the most significant swim in human history. And the reaction from the Chinese press was about as fawning as you can imagine, without even the foreknowledge of why I'm going to call it the most significant swim ever. Well, the Chinese press pretty much treats it as if that's the case, as if this is one of the most impressive things anyone has ever done. They heap massive amounts of praise on the chairman, quashing any rumours that may have been around about his health at that age. Look how vigorous he was. No sign of fatigue. Not bothered by the wind and the waves, Mao himself wrote a poem about it. He said, "I care not that the wind blows and the waves beat. It is better than idly strolling in a courtyard." He even compared it to geopolitics, stating that everyone says the Yangtze is huge. Huge doesn't make it scary. Isn't American imperialism huge too? But we took a jab at it during the Korean War, and there was not much to it. So there are some big things in this world that are not scary at all. Literally, parades were thrown about this. A whole swimming craze followed, as people asked themselves, how could they be more like the chairman? Something like 8,000 people swam across a body of water in Beijing in solidarity. In another city, thousands would visit a lake every day to swim after a part of it is turned into a kind of pool, after Mao's example. And perhaps it's just a direct, you know, an inescapable result of how many people are going to engage in this physical activity. But one historian noted that at least a couple of people were dying every day from drowning because of this swimming craze that the chairman had caused. Now this big swim for Mao, this was far more than just a bit of exercise to show himself still in good health. That doesn't get you the title of most significant swim in human history. Not in my books. No, the reason that this is so important is because it was, and I'm not sure how often this phrase is uttered either, but this was a political swim, part of a plan, part of a new revolution in China that the chairman had been warming up toward and envisioning, perhaps since the days that he was slightly marginalized after the failures of the Great Leap Forward about 4 years prior. Mao's July 16th swim in the Yangtze was a trap being sprung. The week before his swim, and amongst a growing fervour around the country, particularly amongst students, which I will explain in a moment, Mao wrote to his wife, Jiang Qing, Madam Mao, and someone who was part of a kind of brains trust for Mao, a very close group to him that he felt he could trust more than some of China's official senior leadership. This group had been assembled to help propagate his coming vision. In this letter, he wrote that, and I'll quote Philip Short's quote of the letter in his biography of Mao, quote, "Great disorder under heaven yields to great order. And after 7 or 8 years, great disorder starts all over again. Monsters and demons leap out. Given their class nature, they cannot do otherwise. I'm confident, even though I doubt myself a bit, I always feel that when there are no tigers on the mountain, the monkey becomes king. Things always go to the opposite extreme. The black band is trying to overthrow me. Our present task is to overthrow the rightists, at least partially, for to do so completely is impossible. And in 7 or 8 years, another movement will have to be launched to wipe out the monsters and demons. And that will be repeated many times in the future." End quote. Now, I know there's a lot there, and it's a little divorced from context as well, and quite poetic, but the core message is actually all there and contains an actually pretty concise and direct plan of an ideologue and the ideological ends that are going to be pursued. And what will be known as the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution, or just the Cultural Revolution for short. Mao is saying that even in disorder, in chaos, in revolution, this system eventually settles into order, and that it's then that these class monsters will inevitably rise again. That the rightists are, well, they're back, and they need to be defeated, and that this process will need to be carried out again and again. That there has been a growing resistance to his vision, to the true communist path, and that has led to a sneaking back of those wishing to take a capitalist road. And if that sounds a little vague, well, I tend to agree with you. And the Cultural Revolution will be absolutely run on this vague ideological pursuit. There will be anarchy. There will be blood, death, and chaos. But that will be the prescription that Mao had settled upon. This was perhaps one of the first cases in history where someone will use their own popularity, of which might not find too many rivals in all of history either, to turn a population in on itself. But more than that, against a system and party that Mao himself had presided over. It will be a revolution against a barely much older revolution, and just on the heels, really, of the Great Leap Forward. As I said, it's an absolutely terrifying period of history, and some could say that the signal for its launch was a swim. As Philip Short says, quote, "Mao's trap was about to be sprung. Having spent the years since the Great Leap biding his time with the cunning of the monkey, it was time to become a tiger again." So this trap that's being sprung, signaled by his swim in the Yangtze, this coming cultural revolution, this was all part of a darkness that Mao had felt personally enveloping him, and perhaps more importantly, his legacy, as well as his People's Republic of China. Remember, it was in the 1950s that the then Soviet leader, Khrushchev, where he delivered this so-called secret speech, and it sent shockwaves through the communist world as it denounced Stalin, denounced his crimes, denounced his cult of personality, very importantly. We discussed this at length in the episode dealing with the Great Leap Forward and the Sino-Soviet split, and it was in no small part a result of Khrushchev's perceived revisionism that had in some ways influenced Mao's decision to embark on his plan for China to surpass the Soviets as the world leader of communism, as well as an industrial might which could rival any other. Now, this wound itself into an initial attempt at more open political dialogue, the so-called Hundred Flowers campaign, which, when it actually resulted in people questioning the government, was followed by swift and bitter reprisals for those that had spoken out. Now, following this, the Great Leap Forward was embarked upon, beginning in 1957, and by 1962, tens of millions of people had been worked, beaten, and starved to death. In the aftermath, naturally there is a degree of blame to be apportioned to the hands of Mao, the architect and drive behind this, well, perhaps the largest famine in human history. Mao takes one or two steps back from the spotlight, but he is most certainly not done. He is still the chairman, and he begins planning a counterattack to stop the possibility of a Chinese Khrushchev, who might be able to seize this moment and destroy the chairman's legacy. Following the disastrous Great Leap, Mao's top lieutenants, Liu Shaoqi and Deng Xiaoping, had sort of stepped into the picture to do what they felt needed to be done to fix things up a bit. They had reversed Mao's preference for ideological redness over technical and scientific expertise. They invited many of China's intellectuals, many of whom had been severely maligned in the aftermath of the Hundred Flowers campaign, to come back and contribute to this much-needed reconstruction. Now, this must be pointed out when discussing the coming Cultural Revolution, because Mao's contempt for Khrushchev and his notion that the Soviets were destroying the work of the prophets that had come before, well, he felt the same was happening in China. In historian Frank Decotta's words, what Mao was planning would be a way of preserving his legacy, while also addressing this question of how to allow for the worldwide communist revolution to continue in spite of the so-called revisionism that he was seeing in the Soviet Union. Mao thinks that the capitalists are eliminated in the wake of the 1917 revolution in Russia. Likewise, in his own version of this in the People's Republic of China in 1949. But Mao thinks that the capitalist culture somehow lives on and is now presenting itself as this return to a kind of status quo, a return to the capitalist road. The monsters and demons that he spoke of in the letter to his wife. Mao wondered that perhaps even Liu Shaoqi, considered his heir apparent for some time now, perhaps he would be the Chinese Khrushchev and try and erase Mao's legacy once he was gone, or perhaps even while he was still alive. Well, the answer, well, it would be to eliminate this capitalist culture once and for all, to radically test the leadership of the Chinese Communist Party, to reshape and re-revolutionize the masses and the very structure of the society that Mao and the communists had themselves built. And this would take the shape of the Cultural Revolution. Okay, so before I mentioned that this swim, this aquatic spring of the trap, this was occurring amongst a somewhat, well, there'd been a bit of a fever pitch being reached in some parts of Beijing, particularly for students. For months, if not years, this temperature had been gradually increasing. And in fact, Pol Pot had been witness to this during his time in Beijing as well. Now, it was a concerted effort stemming from Mao in the aftermath of the Great Leap, what he proclaimed to be a massive socialist education campaign. Now, initially started as a way for him to regenerate his cult of personality in the military, it then began to target the nation's youth generally. Study sessions conducted by Maoist political instructors sent out to schools, universities, and local branches of the Communist Youth League promoted the study of the recently released Little Red Book, the collection of Mao's sayings and aphorisms. This was aimed at completely indoctrinating the Chinese youth into militarism, Maoism, and class hatred. Mao had come to envision a blurring of the lines between military organization and political action, where the army and people became less distinct from one another, where military discipline and know-how met political energy and widespread support. By the end of this campaign, you will have a whole generation who are just itching to carry out class warfare, to do revolution. The Socialist Education Campaign was Mao's attempt at, in the words of historian Richard Baum, immunizing peasants, students, and the military against Soviet-style revisionism. Mao had perceived this steadily creeping capitalism, but it was possibly not just out in the masses. No. He saw some top members of leadership and various bureaucratic circles in places like Beijing as having these tendencies. By 1964, he said, perhaps in response to that lack of zeal and vigor that Liu Shaoqi and Deng Xiaoping had displayed in response to the socialist education campaign, well, he said that the new goal of the socialist education movement was now to rectify power holders within the Chinese Communist Party who take the capitalist road. These kinds of ideas that were, you know, that there are these secret capitalists forming little cabals, they were in positions of power as well. This was being transmitted to the youth via these study sessions and the Maoist indoctrination across Chinese educational institutions, high schools, and colleges. The message was also circulating that there were, quote, unhealthy tendencies in the arts, like in cultural and literary areas. Now, I know the phrase has a slightly different connotation now, but what this essentially boiled down to was the search for politically incorrect sentiment in books, plays, and music. Anything that didn't adhere to strict socialist realism. And there was this one play in particular that really caused a stir when it was explained to Mao that it might be this subversive way of criticizing his dismissal of a popular politician during the Great Leap Forward. Like the characters were stand-ins for himself and this general. In response to this, Mao called the opera a poisonous weed. Mao became convinced of the monsters and demons having returned to all quarters of the People's Republic. And in response, and perhaps as part of a concerted step-by-step plan, he makes a calculated decision to all but disappear from public and leave Beijing, which he felt was the core of this return to the status quo. And by May of 1966, events begin to unfold that will lead us to a very important swim in the Yangtze. Amongst a well-publicized fallout from a critique of that play that Mao had denounced, well, the playwright of which, well, he was actually very close to the Beijing party leadership. And this creates a stir whereby everyone connected to this is accused of anti-party crimes, up to and including the mayor of Beijing. And while Mao is still in his hidden from public view and pretty much in a kind of enigma phase, there is a kind of, well, it could be thought of as a kind of spillover where we have serious high officials being called out for being revisionist, basically being counter-revolutionary. And I feel like you see a similar thing today where perhaps there would be a political scandal of some order of magnitude and a list of recriminations about other things that tend to come to light around the same time. And this will often result in dismissals or, you know, resigning from positions. And perhaps I'm linking these things too directly, but it must be thought of, you know, within an atmosphere of political disarray in Beijing, and perhaps a kind of confirmation of Mao's vision that had been instilled in the student population. Well, at this time, at Peking University, a philosophy instructor, presumably meaning the equivalent of a tutor, accused the university president of suppressing the revolutionary masses on campus. And she puts up this massive, well, they come to be known as big character posters. And it's kind of in the name. They're big words on a big poster. So you can read it from pretty far back. And basically, this accuses the leadership of the university of being a bunch of Khrushchev-type revisionist elements. So basically calling people out in this massive way. Mao, in a rare break from his silence at this time, well, he publicly endorses this young woman's act. Instantly, she becomes a hero and an inspiration for other similarly minded students. Now, this, when seen in tandem with those, you know, accused of their anti-party crimes in the leadership, this sets Mao's plan into action. The leadership at the core of where he saw the problem had been severely shaken, and now a radical student movement could also be leveraged against the enemies that he perceived. By June, Liu Shaoqi and Deng Xiaoping were looking at a number of disturbances across numerous Beijing campuses. More and more radical student groups had begun calling out particular school faculties or teachers or administrators. And some had even begun to put up big character posters accusing party members of being revisionist capitalist rotors. In some grim foreshadowing of what was to come, these student outbursts soon began carrying with them a violent and humiliating element. It wasn't enough to just denounce those that they suspected of being revisionists. No, they would break into classrooms. They would enforce a kind of struggle session against teachers or college presidents. They would stick dunce caps on their heads and force them to kneel for hours, splatter ink in their faces, tell them to confess their, you know, their sins. They would berate and slap these people and then parade them around the campus. Remember, this is still communist China. So this kind of, you know, calling out the party publicly and engaging in these radical protests, this was going to be noticed. What were known as work teams were sent in to sort this all out and put an end to the student demonstrations and recriminations. The work teams branded the students as hooligans, and essentially they side with the establishment, as it were. Now, Mao had given his comrades enough rope to hang themselves with here, allowed them to confront this student crisis in a way that would not make them look good. Once he heard about the work teams suppressing the student revolutionaries, well, he decided the weather was right for a swim. And that swim in the Yangtze didn't just put an end to rumors that had begun to spread that Mao had, you know, contracted Parkinson's or had a stroke. It announced a glorious return to politics, as he re-entered the fray to take advantage of the chaos that was brewing in Beijing. He returns to the capital, and the Cultural Revolution is soon unleashed. From the 1st of August 1966, he begins by telling the leaders that sending in the work teams had been a grave mistake, that they had attempted to stifle true revolutionary spirit, and he orders the work teams withdrawn. Madame Mao goes to Beijing University, where she tells these radical students that whoever does not join us in rebellion, let him stand aside. Those who want revolution, stand with us. And this committee of his four trusted allies, separate from the party leadership, this Cultural Revolution group was established, and it actually began to operate most of the major functions of government, as former leaders began to be subjected to these kinds of, well, basically Mao was able to make them look obsolete, as having the incorrect revolutionary attitude, as having gone down the wrong path. Mao, arriving when he did, a bit of a splash, began to organize massive student rallies where he endorses, you know, he sees more than a million students in a couple of months, and he's able to sort of endorse the way they are operating. He guides this wave of energy in a way that perfectly paralyzes those he wished to marginalize. And crucially, as it will turn out, as part of guiding this wave, he writes a letter to one young student at a Beijing middle school who had formed a little rebel organization. They were calling themselves Red Guards. And Mao congratulates the young man and coins a phrase that will guide this wave even further, writing to him, "To rebel is justified." And the slogan of the Cultural Revolution was set. At one mass rally, they called on students to overcome all obstacles, liberate their thinking, and carry out a thoroughgoing revolution. And soon the Red Guards become a kind of widespread institution. Millions of students form their own version of this loosely defined revolutionary ideal. They arrive in the capital to be received by Mao in drab, olive, military-style uniforms with bright red armbands and waving their little red books. And they chant, "Long live Chairman Mao, a long, long life to Chairman Mao." The students had received the clearest possible endorsement of their radicalism and had been instructed to carry out a revolution. To rebel was justified, and Mao's embrace of the Red Guards would begin a cycle of increasing violence on their behalf as they did exactly that. By August 8th, having successfully outmaneuvered some of his previously most trusted and well-adorned lieutenants, confidants, and comrades in government, Mao and his Cultural Revolution group essentially take control of all decision-making processes within the government. And this new movement decrees what becomes known as the 16 Articles, an instruction manual for the Cultural Revolution, which was now officially underway. I'll read to you a section which I think provides the gist. Quote, "At present, our objective is to struggle against and overthrow those persons in authority who are taking the capitalist road, to criticize and repudiate the reactionary bourgeois academic authorities and the ideology of the bourgeoisie and all other exploiting classes, and to transform education, literature, and art and all other parts of the superstructure not in correspondence with the socialist economic base, so as to facilitate the consolidation and development of the socialist system." End quote. The target seemed to vaguely include authority itself as a problem. And more than 1 million students descended from all over the country to Beijing for these massive rallies where Mao would even meet with Red Guard representatives. By September, all schooling and lessons had been cancelled, and students were instructed to form Red Guard detachments and go and make revolution. And the Red Guards, filled to the brim with political energy, were fully unleashed, and their righteous chaos and accusations fully endorsed by the man whose thoughts they considered to be a kind of verifiable gospel. And as Philip Short says, quote, "A whole generation of young Chinese was ready to die and to kill for him with unquestioning obedience. And kill they did." End quote. And they would start where you might imagine they would start. They started where they were, the schools. And they would purify their schools and universities through the acts that we described before, by calling out through these big character posters, by publicly humiliating, putting dunce caps on teachers and principals they accused of being capitalists, made to confess in front of crowds. And they were beaten with belts, with brooms, with fists. And soon these brutal assaults began to fatally wound the victims. This spiraled out of control, and with more and more encouragement, begins to remind us of something out of revolutionary Paris. In one Beijing middle school, Red Guards wrote, "Long live the Red Terror," on the walls of a classroom that had been turned into a kind of interrogation chamber. Red Guards wrote, "Long live the Red Terror," on the walls of a classroom that had been turned into a kind of interrogation chamber. The descent into violence here is so swift and so shocking, so widespread. Imagine in the space of just a couple of months, of every high school and university in your town or city took on a transformation into a place where the students within could utilize the kind of violence that the police or armed forces could. Like if practically overnight, the same weight that you would ascribe to a police officer ordering you to get on your knees, or the seriousness of a member of the armed forces telling you to open the door to your house, that, you know, that kind of obedience to those that wield force. Imagine if all of that power, and let's be honest, fear, needed to be given to an entire student population with the arrogance, recklessness and self-righteousness of youth still very much baked into their operating systems. The violence on campus was terrifying. Teachers bundled outside, stripped naked, beaten half to death, made to confess their bad traits, then quite often beaten to death, and then even their families were hounded down. But it wasn't limited to schools. the students rounded up those they suspected of being these capitalist monsters and demons. They went through housing blocks. No one was immune. They rampaged. They burned books. They overturned tombstones. They tear down temples, vandalized cathedrals. Remember, this was an assault on culture itself. So households are just raided, and anything that had these overt ties to the past, particularly prior to 1949, are simply confiscated and often destroyed. They were urged on to destroy the four olds: old thought, old culture, old customs, and old practices. You might recall the four pests that were targeted in the Great Leap Forward. This is a similar thing, and waves of violence are unleashed. And the killings were not punished. A central directive approved by Mao in August stated that the police would be prohibited from suppressing the student movement. This soon becomes systematic tortures and killings. Philip Short shares the experience of Ken Ling, who was a Red Guard at the age of 16, who describes the horrible torture of a 60-year-old teacher with beating, cutting with glass and thorns, being brought back to consciousness with splashes of cold water and beaten further. Eventually, after he shouted at them to kill him for hours, and after he was sexually assaulted, this 60-year-old teacher collapsed for the last time in his own excrement. The killers summoned a doctor who issued a death certificate saying he had died from a sudden attack of high blood pressure. His wife was summoned to confirm this cause of death and then told to take the body. And Ken Ling remembers the students being a little frightened when they had killed the man. He himself remembers having nightmares that night. But then, quote, "I mustered up the courage to go to school the next day to witness more of this torture. After 10 days or so, I became used to it. A blood-smeared body or a shriek no longer made me feel uneasy." End quote. A teacher who will survive the revolution, although he had been crippled by students during it, well, he remembered his experience, again captured by Philip Short in his biography of Mao, and I'll quote him here. "On the athletic field, every few days, several teachers would be taken out and shot in public. Some teachers were buried alive. On the roof of that building over there, four teachers were ordered to sit on a pack of explosives and forced to light themselves. There was a tremendous sound, and nobody could be seen. Only legs and arms were in the trees and scattered over the roof. Altogether, about 100 school officials were killed." End quote. In Beijing alone, by the end of September, that's about a month after the Cultural Revolution is officially begun by Mao and his Cultural Revolution group, more than 1,700 people have been beaten to death. Soon, and in another echo of the French Revolution, the Red Guards begin factionalizing, begin turning on each other, initially along class lines, between those students whose families might come from worker backgrounds or peasant backgrounds, or along the lines of those whose families had party connections. And these factions will soon engage in limited fighting on the streets. They will even set up their own kinds of detention and re-education centers, where they will punish and discipline those within their own ranks. And if you shudder at the thought of what a mass of young, power-mad, foaming-at-the-mouth ideologues might do when they begin to torture these young men and women, well, you should. It is just as bad, and even worse, than you might imagine. Not just heavy beatings, but real torture. I'll spare you the details here. The Red Guards, they attempted to make Beijing pure, with all of the aforementioned destruction and violence that was required. And the Cultural Revolution group had little to no concern for the killings. For Mao, this represented a new generation engaging in doing revolution. And for him, for his vision, this had become a necessary process. The need for continual revolution, to continually sweep clean the monsters and demons by their class nature, cannot help but burrow in and attempt to steer the revolutionary zeal and systems towards a capitalist road. But Mao's vision of these revolutionary youth purifying the upper echelons of the party, well, it had spilled out over the country, and it was ordinary people who were being attacked, being purified. Frank Dikotter discusses in his book, The Cultural Revolution, A People's History, an instance where around 300 people were killed in the outskirts of Beijing, in Daxing County. An extermination of a whole class of people was undertaken, supposedly a landlord class and their families, accused of plotting revenge against the party. I'll quote him at length here. A night of butchery followed, carefully coordinated across several people's communes. Party activists joined the local militia in locking their victims into their own homes or makeshift prisons. They were taken out one by one. Some were clubbed to death, others stabbed with chaff cutters or strangled with wire. Several were electrocuted. Children were hung by their feet and whipped. One 8-year-old girl and her grandmother were buried alive. Entire families and their children were killed, as they wanted to make sure that there would be none left to take revenge years later. Most of the bodies were thrown into disused wells and mass graves. In one case, the stench became so overpowering that the villagers had to dig out the bodies and throw them into a pond instead. End quote. He goes on to say that an officer in the army sent a report about the killings, which was passed on to the Cultural Revolution Group, who didn't lift a finger in response. Mao Zedong thought, Mao himself, he had transcended from just being venerated into something closer to worship. Someone who owned a poster of Mao that was seen to have a small puncture hole in it could be seen as a potential counter-revolutionary. At workplaces in the morning, everyone would stand in a rigid formation and bow 3 times before a portrait of Mao. Red guards were seen telling the victims of their terror to pray to Mao for forgiveness. The little red book became imbued with supernatural power. The whole country was engulfed in this purity of his vision. He could issue verdicts on different factions, turning millions on millions. He could change his mind in a flash. He thrived. In Philip Short's words, quote, his deification, the fanaticism of the Red Guards, created a climate of militancy and menace so overpowering that no one could oppose him. The chairman was elated. At his 73rd birthday party, he proposed a toast to the unfolding of an all-round nationwide civil war. End quote. He would soon realize, however, that just relying on students would not be enough, and soon the impoverished workers and peasants were sought out to join this maelstrom of Maoism and continual revolution. This, essentially, led to a point where almost everyone in the country was given this, you know, tacit permission to form a kind of revolutionary group, to organize and struggle, like the Red Guards, to tear down any perceived vestige of the Four Olds. These factory workers and other similar groups who started calling themselves revolutionary rebels would form another wave of ideological energy for Mao to use to smash his own systems to pieces. And he will take China even closer to the brink of a kind of an almost pure anarchism. But that doesn't mean that the young Red Guards are done. In fact, by 1968, they had begun to carry out their factionalism to such an extent that they had genuinely begun just walking into barracks with impunity, picking up arms and light artillery, and walking out. The army had still been issued strict orders not to suppress the Red Guard movement. But as a result, we literally have different Red Guard groups genuinely engaging in armed, well-armed skirmishes in the streets. Government buildings, parts of cities, they turn into war zones. In Wuzhou, Guangxi province, 2,000 homes were destroyed as part of this infighting, and 40,000 people were left homeless. And if it couldn't get any more extreme, in this same province, reports emerged of serious cases of ritualized and gruesome violence, even involving cannibalizing the organs of enemies that had been killed. It's just, I've realized I'm repeating myself here, but it is a terrifying part of history. Mao and the Cultural Revolution Group would often make requests for all of these rival factions to reconcile their differences, but they can only seemingly set themselves upon more destruction. The Cultural Revolution's effects are not just confined to the People's Republic either. In the last episode, we spoke about the effects in Cambodia, the effects on, say, someone like Sihanouk, but the actions of the Red Guards do have a negative impact on the Sino-Soviet split as well. The 60s had seen a steady decline in the relationship between the two countries, what is known as the Sino-Soviet split, which we also introduced back on that episode on Maoism. So with all of Mao's bluster about Khrushchev and, you know, revisionism and all of that, there is a sort of brief border conflict between India and China in 1962, and the Soviets remain very neutral towards this. They don't really offer any kind of overt support for the Chinese. And in a sort of tete-a-tete, Mao was publicly criticizing Khrushchev's performance, his backing down, over the Cuban Missile Crisis. Now, by 1964, China had tested its own nuclear device without help from the Soviets, which was a massive deal, really, announcing a kind of strategic independence from the Soviets that only put more pressure on this split as it, you know, fast becomes a chasm. We will return to the wider implications and the geopolitical realities of the relationship between the two socialist superpowers at the end of the episode, but for now, in terms of the Red Guard chaos, you will have naturally assumed that the kind of Maoist rhetoric about Khrushchevites and the like will have permeated the radical Red Guard movement, and you have to ask yourself, where would they aim that kind of attention? Well, in 1966 through 67, you have thousands of Red Guards demonstrating at the Soviet embassy, shouting their slogans, even renaming the street the Struggle Against Revisionism Street. And you have, you know, people being spat at on their way to, you know, the embassy and things like that. And it's not the only one. On the other side of the Cold War, I suppose, the British embassy is set on fire in August of 1967. I was reading a British newspaper from that time, and, you know, it's talking about youthful Maoists and that the communications from the embassy sort of went dead as the last thing they said was, they're coming in. Like, really dramatic stuff, particularly, you know, in the fairly normalized world of regular diplomatic relations, like someone's embassy being set on fire is really extreme. And you have the world sort of watching on as this happens. It's really crazy. Where else? So at the North Vietnamese embassy as well, seeing that they were taking more assistance from the Soviets in the war with the US, and therefore, in the Maoist mindset, taking a revisionist path over the Maoist one. And perhaps quite annoying in a very practical way in regard to that war effort. I mean, apart from just, you know, shouting slogans at an embassy, you also have Red Guards raiding freight trains that were stocked with armaments in transit from the Soviet Union through China to Vietnam. So as the world sort of watches on as this chaos ensues, there is a turning point in January of 1967, what will become known as the January Storm. And this begins with more than 100,000 revolutionary rebels, so less the Red Guards and more, you know, factory workers and people like that. But they confront, I think it's about 20,000 government-organized people. Essentially, the 100,000 win. Basically, they take control of Shanghai and sort of replace all of the existing power structures there. And this is initially applauded by Mao, which then spurs other similar groups across the country and other cities to do similar things. You've got factories, offices, commercial establishments across the land all descending into this kind of anarchy where, like I said, these existing power structures are replaced with kinds of, they're called, sort of like an ad hoc thing, it's called a revolutionary committee, which, due to the bottom-up nature of this entire cultural revolution, are poorly managed and often susceptible to the kinds of infighting and score settling that many of the Red Guard factions had been as well. As government structure itself begins to be overthrown, the anarchy brought to the country by Mao seemingly reaches a kind of boiling point where it can only now begin to just evaporate into steam. While Mao's goal of destabilizing the leadership of his party has been realized, as previously senior officials are either relegated, put in prison, publicly humiliated, or disappeared, as he reigns supreme and his cultural revolution group, the rest of the country falls into factions of those now fighting each other. They all claim fealty to Mao and Maoism, but it's person against person, rebel group against rebel group, Red Guards against Red Guards. This, however, this loss of Shanghai to this revolutionary committee and these committees coming up everywhere, but what that means, and again, this is amongst all the other chaos I described, but it's at this point, basically from February of 67, where Philip Short describes a crossing of the Rubicon, an acknowledgement that the compass has been lost. Like I said, it's not that things stop overnight here. Like I said, you've got people looting military bases for some time from this point still, but this seemed to be a bridge too far for Mao. I'll quote Short at length here because he nails it, as always, and this is after the Shanghai group has basically tried to establish a kind of a commune, which would have seemingly been one of Mao's ideals for this whole cultural revolution, right? Well, in any case, here is Short's summary of the January storm. Quote, "The reality was rather different. The Shanghai leader's move had forced Mao to look into the abyss, and he did not like what he saw. A system based on the Paris Commune, with free elections and unrestricted political activity, meant allowing the masses to rule themselves. This was the logic of his injunction to trust the masses and rely on them. The logic, in fact, on which the entire Cultural Revolution had been based. But where would that leave the party? As he put it to Zhang Chunquao, there must be a party somehow. There must be a nucleus, no matter what we call it. Truly free elections were a utopian dream. Doing away with leaders and overthrowing everything might look progressive, but in fact it was reactionary and would lead to extreme anarchism." End quote. What Short explains there, to me, so perfectly encapsulates so much that we've described in our episodes about the formation of communist thought, and then looking at the Soviet experience and now the Maoist one. Like, there's this point that it seemingly inevitably arrives at, where the theory hits the real world and it results in human misery, or it results in a leadership frantically pulling at levers that will ensure that their vanguard or their party will somehow still remain in a position of basically totalitarian power over their population. It's this inherent conflict in what Mao was preaching, that they were to trust the masses, rely on the masses, let the Red Guards beat as many people as they need to, it's all part of the revolution. This part of making the correct path to socialism viable. Part of bringing communism closer. The need to challenge authority, to rebel. Except, against our party, or more accurately, my party. My power must remain. That the economy and national security did need to be insulated from all of this revolutionary activity, well, that's what ends up needing to be the case. Just as the rallying cry had been, what, workers of the world unite, you've got nothing to lose but your chains, well, in the Soviet Union you were very likely to be put in chains and put to work in a gulag. And in China, you might be one of the tens of millions who would be starved, beaten, or worked to death in the name of guiding Marxism-Leninism to a higher stage. After the Shanghai Commune events and after these revolutionary committees began to be set up in different cities across the country, the chairman switched gears into a kind of ideological retreat. By August, Mao takes steps to rein it all in, and even some members of the Cultural Revolution group are arrested. Rebel groups are forbidden from stealing weapons from the military, which is a wild thing to have to say, by the way. Hey everyone, no more stealing from the army, okay? And this is just, I guess, the point that it has to get to, you know, for this kind of experiment. Like, in the same way that the Great Leap Forward was pretty much a social experiment, you know, setting a hypothesis like, I believe that with sufficient will and guile and good old-fashioned hard work, that if we basically put everyone to work in collective farms, and then we put everyone to work making metal, well, then our economy will exponentially grow and our country will attain communism. And then you run that experiment, and tens of millions of people die. And then about 5 years later, basically, you know, the same guy says, okay, well, I've got another experiment. What if we indoctrinate the youth in our country to such an extent that they believe they can do no wrong, and then we tell them that there are counter-revolutionaries everywhere, above and below, and that forming their own militia and going out and destroying some ill-defined markers of old culture, well, this will make their quasi-deific leader pleased. So what happens when you run that experiment? What happens when you keep that experiment going? To the point where everyone joins in. Everyone does revolution. And I do, like, I genuinely find it hard to get my mind around this whole period of history, because on the one hand, it's fairly straightforward. It is this social experiment, and the results of running that experiment make sense. But on the other hand, it's just so utterly baffling to have begun this experiment. Can you even begin to imagine what it would be like to have lived through it? It's absolutely outlandish. It's like something out of Lord of the Flies. Well, how does the experiment end? How does it all go? Well, just for, you know, history's sake, I will say that someone like Decotta will break the Cultural Revolution up into distinct periods. He deems these, the first period being the early years, sort of, you know, 62 to 66, with the moves that will allow the next period to occur, the so-called Red Years, where the Red Guards are unleashed. And these are followed by the Black Years, beginning in 1968 and lasting until 1971. Now, we won't really get too far into the Black Years in this episode, but we will revisit China briefly, often, as various members of the Communist Party of Kampuchea, as well as a certain prince, will be spending plenty of time in Beijing over the next decade or so. In any case, in this discussion of the Cultural Revolution, we've seen the Red Guards unleashed, the chaos that ensues when anarchy is given access to military-grade arms and ammunition. And then we get to this point around 1968 where, as Short said, Mao has looked into the abyss and not much cared for what he saw. So how do you rein things back? How do you rebuild from here? Governing bodies in virtually all Chinese provinces were being replaced by new revolutionary committees. Now, as we said, many of these are paralyzed by disputes about who had the authority to do what. To address this, military officers were usually appointed to fill the top positions in most of the revolutionary committees. The army is really relied upon to bring back order to the country. In fact, by August of 1968, the army is authorized, finally, to use force to suppress Red Guards who were still engaging in large-scale destructive acts. This was the required tonic to finally dispel the pandemonium. The only institution that could arrest this was the army itself. And following this, thousands of what were known as Mao Zedong thought propaganda teams, which were led by the army, were sent into schools, factories, and villages. For some time now, the message to students and workers alike had been something along the lines of, It's time to go back to work. It's time to go back to school. You can do revolution after you've finished work. And once the Red Guards and revolutionary rebels were brought to heel, well, perhaps one of the saddest episodes in this utterly depressing saga occurs. And what do you do with the Red Guards? What do you do with these kids? And even, bizarrely to say, but practically, they've been out of school for a couple of years. Remember, class has been cancelled. What do you do with those that were supposed to graduate? You've got, well, a few million youths on your hands now, and many of those had been pretty extreme in that couple of years. Well, Mao revived, or altered perhaps is the better phrase, a program of, quote, rustification, end quote, where lack of employment and other factors had basically allowed for a kind of voluntary system where, you know, you might finish school, there's not many jobs, so you kind of volunteer to head out to the country, you know, do your time out there, get to know the land, get your hands a bit dirty, learn some things, then you come back to the city and you got a job. Well, this time, the rustification program would not be voluntary. It would be compulsory. And more than 5 million young people were sent to the countryside. And it wasn't just for a year or two like it had been for volunteers in the past. It was permanent. They were sent off singing revolutionary songs, but they had no idea how bleak it would be. They were sent to rural villages and remote border regions. One-way ticket. Their status sort of altered so they could never come back to urban life or indeed to further education. And for many, the conditions they faced were dark. In some provinces, they live in caves, pigsties, and temples. And naturally, girls would face a higher risk of sexual assault. The program becomes a kind of dumping ground. And they have become known collectively as China's Lost Generation. But as we follow the timeline on from here, the use of the military as this vital instrument, perhaps one of the few viable instruments left to effect a degree of stability in this time, this period post-Red Guard chaos, as we said, referred to as the Black Years by Frank Decotter. This is where the army, beginning with their roles as leaders of the new revolutionary committees across the land, well, he describes this almost like the People's Republic becoming like a garrison state, which you can almost imagine as the, you know, the kind of curfew being enforced following a period of extended riot. The army is in control of most of the spaces below the party leadership, and indeed basically hold a majority of the sort of central committee once they're elected after a plenum in 1969. Decotter points out, however, that even though the so-called Red Years are the most infamous of the Cultural Revolution, and makes sense, he says it's actually within the Black Years that the majority of killings are undertaken in the Cultural Revolution. And he says that rather than revisionists and capitalist roaders being the targets for humiliation, isolation, and in some cases meeting violent ends and suicides being rampant as well, now a seemingly more serious sense of enemies, spies, and renegades become the target. As we said, if we imagine a garrison state, this is what the Black Years represent, and perhaps this turn of phrase, you know, from capitalist roader to, you know, enemy spy, this turn from simple Maoist rhetoric into something slightly more, well, serious might not be the right word, but calling someone a spy as opposed to calling them a deviationist certainly marks a difference in the ideological culture. And perhaps that has more to do with this real tension with the Soviets that has grown during this time. This period in the mid to late 60s really marks the end of simple trash talk about who's the real deal in some sense between the Chinese communists and the Soviets. It goes from trash talk into, you know, light shoving. As we said before, we have the Soviet embassy pretty much under siege in Beijing. Serious thing to do at any time, but this was after the quite shocking display of independence of China going nuclear in 1964, and then the ousting of Khrushchev, with Leonid Brezhnev taking control of the Soviet Communist Party. And once Brezhnev takes the helm in 1964, and by the way, Khrushchev, you know, being ousted from the party leadership, it doesn't have nothing to do with Chinese nuclear tests, by the way. That's, you know, that's seen as a bit of a bungle on Khrushchev's part, although there were other issues. In any case, in 1964, there is this brief hope in some quarters that this might lead to a more relaxed relationship between the two superpowers. And this is at the point, particularly in 1965, when the United States' commitment to fighting a war in Vietnam had become a verifiable reality. Well, Brezhnev sort of saw this as an opportunity to reach out to Mao and say, well, we can cooperate on this. But Mao, by this point, is flat out against this deal with the revisionists. And he still, you know, despite leadership change, pretty much maintained that the Soviets were representing a kind of heresy. Fast forward to 1966, and the events we have been covering during those so-called Red Years, and the Soviets, in response to what was basically just looking like an absolute dumpster fire on their border, well, they suddenly begin to raise their defenses a little and send a few more troops than usual to the border with China. And this is where the talk gets pretty serious. And in December of 1966, Chinese Foreign Minister Chen Yi flat out accuses the Soviets of conspiring with the United States to launch a surprise attack on the Chinese mainland, claiming that the Chinese people are ready for war, and we are confident of a final victory. Any nuclear bombs which fall on China will be returned with interest. And if that wasn't scary enough, things are ratcheted up even more from the middle of 1968 onward. And remember, the coincidence with the Black Years and Garrison State period of the Cultural Revolution happening during this time. But a really significant event happens on the 20th of August 1968. When Soviet troops invade Czechoslovakia to overthrow a reformist government, basically trying to bring a degree of liberalization within a Soviet republic from within, and well, it was almost a self-determination to steer clear of the kind of Soviet socialism that was deemed mandatory by Moscow. These actions, you know, invading Czechoslovakia, it's explained by the Russians along the lines of having to protect the socialist system, where it was threatened, within the Soviet bloc. It became known as the Brezhnev Doctrine, but it was nominally only supposed to be used in Europe. Like, as I said, on that real socialist Eastern European bloc. However, to Mao, well, he thinks this, you know, stinks. This was essentially, just in his eyes, a preamble, a pre-positioning for a possible attack on the People's Republic under the same doctrine. He thought it was a free pass for them to legitimize unilateral force where they saw fit. And, you know, along this almost literal fault line of this Sino-Soviet split, this is where the seismograph really starts to shake. A series of incidents culminating in 1969 sees hundreds of Chinese troops crossing into disputed tracts of territory on the border between the two countries. And one morning ambushing Russian troops and exchanging serious gunfire. Reinforcements are sent, the Chinese are pushed back, with dozens of casualties. 2 weeks later, a similar battle erupts with more than 60 Russian casualties and hundreds of Chinese. And soon after this, another battle occurs, and it even involves artillery and tank assaults. This is, by 1969, eventually diffused, but I would say with gritted teeth, bad vibes, and harsh words having been exchanged. But we're talking serious stuff here, aren't we? And this is also by the time that Nixon has the White House. And the Soviets are a little bit, you know, they reach out subtly and say, you know, just checking hypothetically, what would you do if we did a little something about those Chinese nuclear sites? Now, Nixon flat out rejects discussions on the topic, but for Mao, no doubt getting some sense of this, in a somewhat bizarre turn, or perhaps in a cold and ruthlessly genius one, the Soviets become such an enemy that perhaps the enemy of your enemy becomes your friend. perhaps there was a legitimate case to be made for the détente with the United States. Now, I'll leave that there because it kind of neatly packages up a whole massive part of that historical hurricane for the next few episodes. That's, you know, an El Nino kind of deal for the Cambodian part of the story that's going to be mixing with things for a long time. And as we round out this rather chaotic episode about a rather chaotic part of Chinese history, I suppose it's worth just reflecting slightly on the Cultural Revolution as a whole. And, you know, we've spoken about the early factors leading into it, the fallout from the Great Leap, the distrust that Mao had begun to feel against the Soviets, against his own deputies, his desire to not let his revolution slip away, and his desire to impose some kind of never-ending cycle of revolution in order to veer away from the path that he thought the Soviets had taken, you know, away from this correct path to communism. How he indoctrinated the urban youth in a way that could only be compared to a kind of self-deification. That he crashed this fist of youthful energy and commitment to his cult of personality to destroy and rebuild the structures of his party across the country. As historian of the period Andrew Walder suggests, this was the vision of a committed ideologue who tore his own system apart in pursuit, as we mentioned, of fairly vaguely defined ideological ends. And where Mao had imparted the gift of doing revolution to a whole generation who had missed out. Now, we've covered the chaos that this Cultural Revolution brought, but I realise I've not given a specific death toll throughout. Most scholars, including Chinese scholars, will suggest somewhere between 750,000 to 1.5 million deaths, with around the same number being permanently injured. This is a period of mass death, and one struggles to see its point. It was inextricably linked to the Sino-Soviet split, as well as the Great Leap Forward, and it cannot be divorced from Mao. It is almost an equal measure, you know, a result of this one man's extreme power and his feeling marginalized from the political process, concerned of his legacy, but also someone who was deeply committed, who literally believed in revolution and that Chinese society was drifting toward the thing that he hated. And it was his mission to disrupt that. As Mao brought anarchy to his country, as he celebrated a civil war that he had brought about, he had eventually turned away from pursuing this pure cause that, it might be said, the Cultural Revolution was aimed at achieving. And it's here that we can see the blend of the ideologue, as well as the ruthlessness of a highly skilled politician. As Philip Short says, quote, "The Cultural Revolution might appear to be a descent into madness, but Mao had moved at each stage with circumspection. He had made clear from the outset that destruction would have to be followed by rebuilding, and that the Great Disorder, as he had put it in July of 1966, would eventually have to yield to Great Peace." End quote. Officially, as the party began the rather tough task of rebuilding itself in the aftermath of the Red Years and into the Black Years, the Cultural Revolution was considered to be an outstanding success. Mao was credited with raising Marxism-Leninism to a higher and completely new stage, and creating a guiding philosophy for the era when imperialism headed for total collapse and socialism toward worldwide victory. That's the official, you know, this is how we're remembering this. Mao Zedong thought was now equal to Marxism-Leninism. And Mao had, more or less, got what he wanted. Top deputies had been purged, all outward manifestations of bourgeois thought and behaviour had been eliminated, the army had stepped into a much more prominent position, and some members of the Cultural Revolution group, one day to be infamously known as the Gang of Four, well, they were also being set up to sort of vie for power with the military as Mao approached his mid-70s. Now, to finish this episode, and perhaps the last episode that will see us completely depart the Cambodian story, I will leave you with Philip Short once again, who describes, artfully, as per usual, at least one view of the aftermath of this Cultural Revolution. Quote, outwardly, China had become a sea of collectively owned grey buildings, of collectively farmed fields, of uniform blue cotton clothes, where the only colour came from the red flags on buildings. Ornament of any kind was forbidden, culture had been reduced to Madame Mao's 8 revolutionary model operas. There was no markets, no street stalls, no peddlers. Every bicycle was black. End quote. I want to thank you for listening this far. I want to thank you for your patience for this series as a whole. I want to thank those that donate to the show and those that leave ratings and reviews and for everyone that gets in touch. Until next time, this is Lachlan Peters, and this is In the Shadows of Utopia.